Hello, hello, hello. Hello, Georgians, hello, global citizens, and hello, concerned Americans. My name is Varun Kadathala, and I'm the current co-host of the Politician Podcast, which myself and my high school best friend Damian Galvin created in June of this year to talk about issues that interest us, issues that disgust us, and issues that America needs to know about. In other words, myself and Damian created this podcast to deconstruct public policy issues of the past and the present and create a more equitable future for all of us. We have a very, very special episode queued up for you guys, but before we play this episode, we're going to give a special thank you to our sponsor, Patreon, and our wonderful team here at Politician, which includes high school juniors Jada Pilling, Yi Shen, and Julia Hartman. Thank you guys so much for listening to this episode, and we hope that you enjoy. See you in the episode.
And we're rolling. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of Politician. My name is Damian Galvin, and as always, I'm joined by my wonderful co-host, Varun.
Hello, everybody. What's going on? My name is Varun Kadathala, and I'm the co-host of this podcast with Damian Galvin here today, talking about issues that young people and old people all care about in today's nation. Me and Damian began this podcast back in June, as you all know, to bring perspective onto issues that we all care about as Americans and to raise conversations in our communities and help people go out in their communities and help out and things like that. And to really get perspective on that today, we have an amazing guest in our podcast, Giselle Fetterman, a big community activist in Pennsylvania who helps out with so many individuals who need help in her home state. And she's also the second lady of Pennsylvania. If you want to go ahead and introduce yourself to all of our viewers today, Giselle, that'd be awesome.
Hi. Thank you for having me. My name is Giselle Bajeto Fetterman. I am currently the second lady of Pennsylvania, but I'm also a nonprofit founder, also a dreamer, and a former undocumented person who's been working and living in America for quite some time now.
I think that we have our research director do amazing research each and every week. And me and Varun were texting after reading the research that she had done on you, and we were just amazed. I mean, it was like we would read one thing and then it was just another thing. I think what came to my mind was the fact that you were a dreamer, but so much more than that. Now you are living the American dream. I mean, you've done so many amazing things for your community. What really got you started going down that path? What inspired you to help others?
So I think, you know, I attribute it directly to my immigrant experience. You know, I came here when I was 7, 8, and, you know, overnight I came from a whole different world. And suddenly I find myself, you know, as a non-English speaker, my mom is now working as a domestic worker. We are dumpster diving and our furniture came from the curb. And I suddenly found myself in this completely different world and I needed to adapt. And, you know, having, coming from such a different place and moving into this country of extreme excess, I was able to easily see how we could problem solve because we had so much here, because I had come from so little. So I think what inspires me, not only is that experience and things I think that would have helped my mom at that time, but it's a gratitude. It's a gratitude that I get to live here. It's a gratitude that I'm safe. And it just makes me want to do more.
That's an amazing story, Giselle. Now, I looked at your, you know, your experience and what you've done in your community, and two things that caught my eye were, first of all, your Hollander Project, the incubator for female entrepreneurs, and beyond that, the Hello Hijab movement to give hijabs to little Barbie dolls, sell those miniature. It's extremely amazing, as Damien was saying, a flurry of things you have on your resume. So I wanted to ask you, just as a general question, do you think that we internalize things like racism, whether it's sexism, racism, discrimination against any people, regardless of what they are currently? Do you think we internalize that in society, and how do we really bridge that gap? Because I know you've been doing stuff with that in the past.
Yeah, I think, you know, I try to think of the person, you know, like I recently had a really negative experience with someone who verbally assaulted me at a grocery store and yelled racial epithet. It was awful. But, you know, I try to remember that this is a person, and this is a person who was not born feeling this way, wasn't born believing these things, but it was guided to this. So this person was taught by someone that they trusted, by someone who should have taught them wrong from right, taught them wrong. And I try to keep that in mind. You know, I don't believe in writing people off. I believe in trying to work with people the same way they've learned racism and hatred, they're able to learn opposite of that. So I don't believe in giving up on people. I believe in trying to reach as many people as possible. And, you know, there are difficult days and there's really difficult and draining conversations. But I believe in trying to reach them.
Yeah, absolutely. It reminds me something that Simon said, one of our past guests. He said that we're all each other on a different day. And it's really important, I think, to remember that as we're having conversations about difficult things, that we all have our own unique perspective that kind of shapes our opinions and our views and our values and our beliefs on different issues. And although it can get extremely irritating, especially now when we're so polarized it's this age of hyperpartisanship, it's difficult to have those conversations. But I think that you keep finding extremely unique ways to inspire those conversations.
I try, and you know, what's hard, you know, there's some realities for me, right? And some realities are that even though my husband is the elected official, I still receive tenfold the amount of hate mail and threats that he does. That's a reality, and that's really, it makes me really sad. But I try to switch the perspective and see it as opportunity, right? This is an opportunity. These are hearts that I need to work on, and these are minds that I need to work on to help change. But that's a reality, and I'm not in any way unique in that. I know that if you are living through this world and navigating this world as an other, you know, if you fall under that category, no one is immune from that. It doesn't matter what you've accomplished or how hard you've worked. To some people, you still will always be viewed as inferior. And that's where the work needs to be to change that.
Absolutely. And before, you kind of mentioned how people don't really look at one another as people anymore. It's often things like numbers. And I think that it does say a lot about America, of us as a people. Damian mentioned this before, but we're on Polititeen. We talk about how people themselves are usually not, you know, internally bad. It's all about the system, the situation in which they're brought up and they live in currently. So that's one of the biggest philosophies that we live by on the podcast. But I wanted to mention that, in terms like the, you know, the illegal immigrants, like you yourself were one, undocumented before, people often consider them as numbers, right? And even beyond that, COVID deaths, they're often numbers. How do we get people to recognize there are eyes behind these issues? There are human beings behind these numbers. And what do you think is the impact, going forward in the future, what is the impact of us recognizing that these aren't just numbers or statistics, they're actual people getting impacted by our solutions and policies?
Right. We have to tell their stories. You know, when I was a young undocumented kid growing up, I looked for those stories and I needed hope. I needed to find someone who had lived through that experience and who had made it out. And I searched for that person and I didn't find them. Those stories weren't being told. So when I made the decision to tell my story, it was because I knew I needed that as a kid. So these are stories that need to be told. I tweeted today, you know, how the virus numbers are up now and there's still people fighting wearing masks. I lost my uncle who raised me June 6th to COVID. You know, and he was amazing. He was my favorite person in the world, and I miss him so much. And these are stories I need to tell. They're painful stories and they're sad stories, but people need to realize that, like, I only have his voicemails to listen to. That's the only way, that's what I have of him, and he's gone. And these are all lives that we could have prevented, we could have saved, and we need to save more lives. It's not about this selfish belief that a mask is this inconvenience because you don't know anyone directly affected. Those affected are around us, and you're going to learn more of that as it continues to spread, as people refuse to follow the mandates.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that we have three others in this call. Varun comes from, you know, Asian descent. I'm, you know, we're both Latino descent and Latina descent. And I think that telling stories is something that's so crucial. I remember on one of the earlier kind of episodes here on the podcast, I mentioned that I've never really had a teacher that looked like me, and that you don't really realize that that impacts you until you're put in a situation where you are seen as the other. Because I think that I've been very fortunate to be oftentimes, obviously, I think every single minority has their story of a racist incident or a situation where they were made uncomfortable because of the fact that they look different. But I've been very fortunate to have those incidents be minimal or have very few of them. And it's not until you're put in those positions that you realize that, I mean, you're just as susceptible. And it's the stories that need to be told and need to be heard. And I think that you're doing an amazing job of representing other people and giving, you know, more so young women. And I think, I mean, just everyone, just an uplifting and inspiring story and hope. I think that we're missing a lot of hope right now.
Thank you. I'll have people that will say like, well, you don't look like you're undocumented.
Wow.
What does that look like, you know? Or I'll have people that will say, well, I don't have an issue with you. You do such nice things. My issue is with the other immigrants. And to me, it fascinates me that someone can break that in their mind somehow and rationalize that thought process. But it's when I can push back and say, well, what do you mean? Like, who is the other? You know, do you know that I was undocumented? I lived here undocumented for over 15 years. Mm-hmm. And then they have to now kind of recalibrate their thinking in their mind, which again is so important to just keep sharing stories.
Absolutely. I think me and Varun can say similar accounts, especially having lived in the South. You hear similar things, you know, when we're doing the podcast as well. It's like, well, we're not talking about you when we're talking about these issues. It's like, well, then who are you talking about? I fit all the categories that you're complaining about. With my parents, I think Varun can say the same thing. Both of my parents speak perfect English. So sometimes they do get that. Oh, like, I mean, my dad was undocumented up until 4 or 5 years ago. And he had lived here in the United States for 30 years at that point. I think critical that we listen to each other and have these conversations regardless of how uncomfortable they are.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we began this podcast, Damien and I, talking about our biggest impetus for starting the podcast was the death of George Floyd, and the racial protests and incidents that followed his death. And I think that's powerful. But beyond that, on almost our 10th episode, I believe, Damien, we had an incident in Forsyth County, Georgia, the place where we live, as you said, the Deep South, wherein students of our county went past a protest for Black Lives Matter and played a racially provocative song from the cars. And I think that after that story was told, it really hit home that we're not just, you know, talking about issues that impact people in Pittsburgh, for example, with Antoine Rose and things like that. We're talking about things that impact people right here in this county beyond just being, you know, afraid in their shoes. We have people literally afraid to sit down in their classrooms because of what's happening and the stories that are being told about this community. I think that we have to reform those things. Now, I do want to talk about, you know, talking about telling a story. Antoine Rose is an important story earlier this year, you know, not this year, I believe, but he was in Pittsburgh and he was called by Meek Mill, one of my favorite rappers, favorite musical artists, as everyone's child. And I think that what's really important about his story was that his mom came out and she talked about how she knows police officers. She knows them. She has relatives who are police officers. And I think she gave an important appeal to the everyday American that it's not just police officers who are the problem in today's world. It's also the system itself that puts them in that position to where they have to resort to violence in stopping crime. So I think that I wanted to ask you what you obviously had a personal relationship with Antoine Rose. How did that impact you and how did it empower you to go forward?
Yeah, that I wasn't expecting that question, so that took me. Antoine was our kid. You know, he volunteered with me at the Free Store since he was young, and I'm really close with his mom and his sister, and I'm so in awe of their strength. You know, Michelle has really taken this heartbreak and really funneled it into activism and has supported so many families. She's been the first call of so many moms who have lost kids. They're just incredible. And, you know, she helped humanize this idea that, you know, there's good and bad in everything and in all spaces. And we know that, but we have to look at the bigger picture. You know, how did that police officer walk away? What systems were in place that viewed this situation and thought that he was in the right when a young man lost his life who was running away? So the issue is much bigger. But Antoine made a huge impact on all of us. All the volunteers miss him. We share stories about him all the time. My favorite one is that he would run after my kids trying to tie their shoes because my kids' shoelaces are always untied. And he was worried that they were going to trip. And he was always chasing them to tie their shoes. And he would call me Miss Giselle. And I would say, you don't, please just call me. He's like, no, if my mom hears me not call you Miss Giselle, I will get in trouble. I mean, he was a really special person and we miss him a lot.
Yeah. And I think that's something that we forget oftentimes is, as Varun was mentioning the statistics earlier, is that a lot of these stories aren't told. And a lot of these stories get overlooked by, you know, the constant, news cycle. And oftentimes there is no story to be told. I want to know, how do we avoid getting numb to these stories? How is it just another one, just another number, just another statistic?
Yeah, unfortunately, exposure does that, right? Mm-hmm. Whatever you're exposed to, it normalizes you to it. And we shouldn't become normalized to anything that's negative. Right? We shouldn't get used to or accept anything that's negative, no matter how much we see of it. And I think that's why, you know, the protests and how the rising up has occurred, it's really been powerful. And we need to always push back when the wrong is happening. We can't ever sit back. We need to find our ways. And it doesn't mean that everyone protests the same way. You know, my activism can be very different than someone else's. But they can all be effective. You know, it doesn't have to be loud. It can be, but not everyone has that in them. And I think for a long time, at least, I felt that my contributions couldn't be effective because I wasn't loud or tough. But I've learned that that doesn't matter. Like, you know, your voice can sound different. Yeah. It can shake. It doesn't matter. There are different ways. And we should try all the ways. And whatever way works for you to be an advocate, to be an ally, to stand up for those who need it, just find the way that works for you.
Yeah, and it's very interesting because you told us in one of your articles online that we saw that, you know, you grew up with this mentality of I had to be silent because that was my status as an illegal immigrant. I couldn't be too loud for fear of being, put into some harm. And I think that I think that right now you're extremely, extremely vocal in your community and you help out everybody who was maybe in your position and is there right now. And I think that this says a lot about who you are. And I think that a lot of people go out and they talk about how our second lady is an extremely, extremely vocal person. She helps me out. She resonates with me. And I think that some of that may be affected by COVID-19. How have you, how is the activism front as a whole and just you going out and talking to citizens been affected by COVID-19? And how have you adapted to it? And how can Americans in our community, in our state, kind of adapt to it and continue to help our communities out and have those important conversations?
Yeah, we've had to look at the way we do everything from the free store to for good. You know, the free store was designed for us to be on top of each other, loving each other and hugging each other and breathing each other. And that kind of was our model. You know, we operate out of decommissioned shipping containers. They're 40 feet long. So we had to really step back and look at the way we did everything and change all that and adapt. And while we had to close for a bit, we were busier than ever because we then began doing safe drop-offs on the porch. We began distributing Narcan. You know, overdoses increased drastically because depression has increased with COVID. So there are all these additional victims, right? There's everyone else who has either contracted or is in the process of it or lost their job. But then mental health is severely impacted as well. So we try to always creatively see how we can continue the work safely and creatively. And we know that with the Narcan we've distributed, we know at least two lives were saved because they were used on two to revive them. So it's we have to constantly learn to adapt. We can't take anything for granted. I think COVID has shown everyone that everything changes. You know, I kind of always argue this idea that no one is above me or beneath me, that we're just beside each other doing our best. And COVID, I think, has shown a lot of people that that's real. You know, people who thought their finances would never change or their health would be always great. They've seen that life is really unpredictable. I think it's humbled a lot of people. It's been really difficult for so many Pennsylvanians. But you have to adapt. You have no option other than to keep going. And I'm so inspired by my community and others across the state who have just found ways to keep going.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one critical thing that you bring up was this conversation about mental health. I don't think that we're enabling this conversation about mental health as much. I think that we're making strides towards it. But you mentioned the Narcan that you delivered and how that saved two lives. But I always think about when I was reading, you know, the research that we had gotten, how many more lives are being impacted and saved, either by future policymakers that you're inspiring or, you know, you mentioned with politics that you don't get into politics because politics are bad and you think that you're good.
I said mean.
There you go. Yes. Mean. Sorry. But you know, it's, how do we inspire this conversation of mental health to keep going? Because like I was saying, you know, I think you're saving lives beyond just literal lives being saved. You're changing lives and inspiring future lives to be saved and inspiring future conversations to be had, which are going to impact lives.
I think it's normalizing, right? There's so much stigma around so many things, whether that's having a medical marijuana card, which I do and I talk about, whether that's asking for help, right? We've made asking for help like it's a bad thing when it's such a human thing. We should all feel comfortable asking for help if we need help, whether it's a mental health episode or something else. It's normalizing being human and being kind to each other. And we need so much more of that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think a lot can be said on that front towards kind of helping people become those allies of these communities. I've had tons of people with mental health issues come up to me and be like, well, I couldn't talk to anybody about this. And I saw you were vibrant in class. And I wanted to talk to you about what I was facing. And maybe you could tell me what I should do. And I think that having people like that and being that kind of person for people can really help them connect with good sources. Personally, I've faced some issues myself in the past based upon my parents are divorced. And we had a really, really, you know, heartbreak separation. I do live with a split household right now, so it's extremely tough for me currently. But I think that being able to resonate with people's opinions and what people are doing right now, people's mental health issues is important in being an ally. So I think that, again, a lot can be said towards that. How can we ensure that we have allies in our community and that people know that it's okay to speak up and it's okay and encourage, you know, that kind of mindset that we have to be allies of one another. How do we encourage people to go out and do things like that?
I mean, it'd be great to see it from elected officials, right? To normalize these conversations and maybe the ones that are in office that aren't doing that aren't the ones that we need in office, right? So it's okay to look for better people, right, to be in better positions. But I think we need to accept that vulnerability is great. Like we should, you know, stop dehumanizing someone being vulnerable and viewing that as weak when it isn't. It's really strong. So I think it goes back to stories. If you have a story and you're comfortable telling it, you should share it. And every story that's shared is going to help so many other people who hear it, who may connect with it, who may be in the same situation. And, you know, my goal is to get to a place where the judgment is gone, you know, and we just accept people and we love them and we accept them and we work with them. And we break all this stigma there is around so many things, like, you know, seeking a therapist. That's a great thing. We should celebrate if someone says they're going into therapy. That's a great thing. But there is a lot of work to be done still.
Yeah. Absolutely. I think that there's definitely a lot of work to be done. And you were talking about how people can like resonate with stories and stuff. And when I was reading about, you know, having this, I guess, feeling like you needed to be silent, it reminded me a lot growing up. My mom would always make sure that I was extremely well dressed and that I always had, you know, short hair and, you know, I would always want my hair to be longer. And she would always tell me that I couldn't because of the fact, you know, that I look different. That I am the other, that I always have to present myself in this best manner to limit the judgment that can be had, and it's sad to think that we've made so much progress, and I think that it would be foolish to overlook that, But I think that it's sad that we still have to think like that, and we still have to, you know, concern ourselves with it, because you mentioned it as you were growing up. And I think that I had, you know, or at least my parents had some of the same fears as I was growing up.
Yeah. Oh, it's absolutely true of immigrant families. And, you know, I joke that to my family, I'm a failure because I'm not a doctor or an attorney. And that's like a immigrant expectation, right? Like, for you to have made it, you're a doctor or an attorney. And I think that's part, that's toxic. I mean, it's funny, but it's toxic, because it's this idea that we have to work much harder to just make it in, to just fit in. And it shouldn't feel like that. No one should have to feel like that. You know, I hate when people are talking about immigration and they try to justify immigrants, saying, well, they're good contributors and this. Well, that's great, but they can just be people, and that's okay too. Right? Or this like push to assimilate, they can bring their culture and their ideas and who they are. We don't need to become all cookie cutter society, right? We should celebrate these differences. That's what's exciting to me, is that people believe in different things and worship differently and have different cultures and holidays. Like, I don't want that to change. I love that and honor that difference in people.
Absolutely. You know, Damien told me, as he told you guys earlier, both of us earlier, about how he had to grow up in that situation of he couldn't grow his hair out long because he was, you know, his mom was an immigrant. He was from an immigrant family. And that's really what many people face today. You talked about how you were, you know, the two highest professions in your culture were attorneys and doctors. And much the same for me. You know, Indians, it's kind of a stereotype, and it's kind of a joke today too. It's that Indians, they want their kids to be engineers and they want their kids to be doctors. And we joke about it in our family, but it really is a reality. You know, we all have war stories. You know, personally, it's not much of a war story, but when I was young, I had my name spelled with two O's. The traditional name for Varun is V-A-R-U-N. My name is spelled V-A-R-O-O-N. And I asked my mom, I was like, when I was very young, and I was like, why do kids who have the same name as me have different spellings? She was like, well, you have to assimilate into this culture to be an American. And it was always a question, which was like, you know, how do I become an American? What does American culture mean, and things like that? And it's really important to ask these questions and overcome that kind of stigma behind these issues like that. I think that even beyond that, you know, talking about national policy and national stigmas, the Trump administration has been continuously cracking down upon DACA. Most recently, they had one of their you know, Chad Wolf's policies, constricting DACA policies, stricken down by the court system. And I think that it goes to show how much we as a nation and our global and nationwide leaders kind of internalize the issue and push it down our throats. Why do you think there is so much stigma towards illegal immigrants, undocumented, and even immigrants in this nation as a whole? Is it xenophobia? Or what do you think, based upon your experience in the community, is a root of this?
Well, I think with the current and soon to be over president, with him, it was, you know, and he would look, you know, DACA are most, you know, they're military. They are, you know, healthcare workers. I mean, these are folks who are taking care of Americans and protecting Americans. And the way he spoke of them and the way he treated them was just criminal. And, you know, I've read all the plans for Biden and, you know, the first 100 days, there's so much work around immigration that he is committed to doing. And I'm very hopeful for that. But, you know, you have the leader of the free world in a microphone saying terrible things. And I don't believe everyone is influenceable, but those who are easily influenced were absolutely influenced by his behavior and his words.
Yeah, I think that we have seen a surge of that. And I think that you mentioned that we need to replace politicians who aren't, you know, willing to have those conversations. And I think that in November, I mean, this month, we did. We replaced a politician that I don't think was representing what it means to be American. You know, I mentioned earlier in the talk where it's like your story is a story of a true American, of what it means to be American, of coming to this country and achieving. And to diminish that, you know, and to have that diminished from the president of the United States, someone that's supposed to aspire all Americans to do that and all immigrants to do that, it's heartbreaking. But I guess I wanted to ask you a little bit about kind of this conversation that's been having about, you know, the political victory versus the moral victory, because we most definitely had a political victory, you know, with Joe Biden winning. But was it still disheartening to see the president of the United States get 72 million votes?
Yeah, it's hard to see that. And again, I try to humanize that in that, you know, cycles are broken, right? You can come from a family that has taught you terrible things and you can break those cycles. But sometimes it takes a while to get there. And a lot of people are still not there. And I try not to get really down about it, because if I really think about that, I would get really, truly sad about it.
Yeah. Yeah,
so I try to not focus too much on that, or I'll cry.
Yeah, no, I completely feel you. When we're talking about kind of the election going on and what happened this November, earlier this month, we have to understand that, you know, Damian mentioned the fact that we should replace these officials who aren't following through on respecting the American people and what we want as a country. I think that, number one, we shouldn't elect them in the first place. And I think that the fact that we have to replace them says a lot about who we are as a people. The fact that this election earlier this month was more of a vindication of his policies than it was a repudiation of his policies, it says a lot about our country. I think that we had an amazing conversation about how we shift thoughts, but I wanted to kind of talk about your efforts with the Lieutenant Governor's mansion. You're running now a public pool, I believe, out of that mansion to help achieve certain social benefits. So that was really interesting to both myself, Damian, and our amazing research director. I'm looking at our document right here, and she was like, look at this one, it's really important. And so we're looking at that right now, and I wanted to ask you, what did this whole humanitarian effort entail, and how has it been working in the past couple of months and weeks?
Sure. So, you know, my husband's role as Lieutenant Governor came with a mansion, and, you know, a mansion paid by taxpayers, which, you know, for us, it felt really uncomfortable. We had no desire to live there. We have a home. We're fine, you know, where we could live in a home. But also, like, no one should pay for our housing. And so it just felt very wrong that this was a thing. But the mansion did come with a pool. And the pool I wanted. I study a lot around statistics, specifically around drowning. And it's always children of color that are drowning. It's, you know, not only a dark racist history around swimming pools in this country, but it's lack of exposure and access. So these are all lives that could have very well been saved. So I wanted to open the pool as a public pool and make it a place that young people who wouldn't have access to swimming otherwise could come and learn safety, swimming, and how to swim, how to survive in a pool, how to have fun and be comfortable in a pool. So this past summer, we weren't able to open because of COVID. But the previous summer, we had a really busy summer, and we had nonprofits and schools and church groups and all sorts of organizations come and learn to swim with us all summer long. And it was the best summer ever.
That sounds really incredible. Do we have a definitive answer as to why it's people of color that tend to drown? Does it have to do with family structure and systemic racism in that aspect, or do we just not know?
So it's because our country has a very racist history around swimming pools. People of color weren't allowed in public swimming pools. And that has carried on. And it's another ugly stain in our history. But, you know, for me, when I look at this pool, if my kids could swim in that pool, then could every child in Pennsylvania. And we worked to make it so. And there was a lot of red tape to work through.
Right.
But the attorneys and everyone was great and helpful, and we were able to get there. And, you know, we had lifeguards and these kids who had never been in the pool in some cases, 10, 12, 14, had never been in the pool, ended their summer feeling confident and happy. And I made stickers. Everyone who came got a really cute sticker that said, "You belong in all the places." And it had a picture of the mansion. And we really truly had one of the best summers.
Yeah. And it's the little things, you know, things that you do for the community is amazing. You have just a plethora of different things you do for the community. And I think that you talked a little bit about how the historical basis, and Damian asked this question, behind how we have African-Americans and minority communities discriminated against in these swimming pools, one of the most basic recreational things in our country. And I think that it goes even beyond just talking about it now. As a student in high school, a big history buff, me and Damian are both big history buffs. We often experience the fact that history textbooks sell history. And I think that they sell history to reflect American patriotism, reflect the American promise, even though the promise is usually, in a lot of senses, not achieved by this nation. You know, I always go back to the Remember the Ladies front and how ladies continue to not be remembered in this nation, even though centuries ago, you know, Abigail Adams asked her husband to remember the ladies. And I think that in textbooks today, especially the ones that we use over in Georgia, the Deep South, they really do a bad job at talking about the hard history that teachers and students sometimes do not want to, do not feel comfortable looking at. And I think that that really pulls back on what history can do in terms of educating people. I really do not like the re-education platform. What do you think we as a, you know, as a citizenry can do to promote education, even though schools, education about hard history, even though schools aren't really doing that? They're giving you the concise patriotic version.
I mean, I think students can organize. I mean, young people are, you know, better at organizing than anyone. you guys can, I think, really organize with, kind of, it's not new history, right? It's the real history. And there's a lot of different groups that have kind of compiled alternative, like the actual teachings that should be taught. I think that there's a good place for young people to really come together and kind of tell the story a better way and hold feet to the fire of their schools to, you know, one, explain, a lot of it is money, right? Like there's certain textbook companies they work with because they have a contract with, and, you know, money is a lot behind a lot of things. But I think that young people are in no better position ever than now to organize, not only in regards to this, but really on anything that you guys care about. You've seen how young people worked with gun violence and how they really put the conversation on a national level. They're the ones who took that and made it a national conversation in most living rooms. And I think you can do the same around anything that you're passionate about, but certainly this.
Absolutely. And I think that you know, I remember the day after or the day of that kind of the election, we saw the direction that the election was heading in. I think Biden had reached 270 at that point. You know, one of our teachers spoke to the whole class and she apologized on behalf of every adult in America. And she said that that adults were failing us by showing us that that it's okay to lie and that it's okay to be, you know, mean to each other and say disgusting things towards each other. And it's always a nice reminder to know that there are those adults that stand up above the rest. And I think that you're definitely one of those adults that is going to keep inspiring every single person that listens to this podcast and has inspired and will continue to inspire. But with that being said, I want to ask you one final question here as we're wrapping up the podcast, as we do with all our guests. If you could say one thing, leave one message, one quote to the American youth, what would it be?
One of my favorite quotes is what you do, everything you do or don't do matters. Everything helps or hurts. Everything gives or takes. And I think it's easy to feel that one person can't have an impact. And it's easy to feel discouraged in times like this. It's really easy to feel that way. But inaction can also be harmful, right? So you have immense talent and creativity and ideas, and I just encourage you to use them and to not feel that you can't make a difference, because you absolutely can. So that quote, you know, on the hard days, I really focus on that quote, that if I, you know, I can do something in this situation, but if I don't do it, I'm actually hurting. I'm actually doing the opposite of helping. So I think that helps re-energize me and to kind of shake me out when I'm in the dark place for a little bit.
Absolutely. And I want to thank both you and Varun for joining me on this episode of the podcast. And it was an amazing conversation to have. I want to thank all of our listeners for tuning in to yet another episode of the Politateen podcast. Be sure to go check out all our social medias. We're going to have some exciting stuff coming up. Speaking of activism, we have a tour drive that we're doing, and hopefully we're going to have a Valentine's Day drive. So if you guys want to be updated on future guests and all the different initiatives that we're doing, be sure to go follow us on Twitter and Instagram, both at Politateen Show. And with that being said, I want to thank everyone for for tuning in to yet another episode of the podcast. Be sure to tune back in on Mondays and Fridays for new episodes. Thank you, guys.
Thank you so much for having me. You guys are amazing.
Hello, 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 everybody. Thank you so much for listening to today's episode of the Politician Podcast. If you enjoyed our conversation, head on over to www.patreon.com/Politician Podcast for more exclusive members-only content, special episodes, and merch drops. That is, once again, www.patreon.com/Politician Podcast. I'm going to make it a jingle when I grow up. It is www.patreon.com/Politician Podcast. No, I'm just kidding, you guys. But definitely visit www.politicianpodcast.com. For more amazing content from myself, Damien, our team, our amazing artwork head, and our sponsors over at Politician. And once again, thank you so much for watching today's episode. Thank you to my co-host, Damien Galvin, for an amazing conversation, my friend. I do appreciate your input, as always. And that said, have a great rest of your weekend. Chime in for the next episode, and we hope you enjoyed today's conversation.